chapter 6 as we continue our series going through Hebrews. Have you ever known somebody who couldn't keep a promise if their life depended on it? I'll take that as a yes. And we all have people in our lives that fit into one of two categories. You've got reliable people and unreliable people. There's not really any middle ground, is there? Either we can trust them or we can't trust them. Now, reliable people we get along with pretty well. We like them, we appreciate them, we know that we can count on them. We know that when they say that they're going to get something done, that when they're going to do something, it gets done. On the rare occurrence that something out of the ordinary happens and they don't get it done, we have a few assumptions that we make, right? Either one, something pretty major must have happened to keep them from accomplishing what they claimed that they were going to do. And we also assume that they did everything in their power to get it done. There's nothing more that they could have done, right? That's what we expect out of reliable, trustworthy people. Now, unreliable people, on the other hand, different story. It doesn't matter that if they're always late, they always do a job only partially done, or sometimes they don't get it done at all. What happens with the unreliable people is they make big promises, but their word isn't worth much to us, is it? We're always wondering if they're going to come through for us. Now, if you're a reliable person, you can make pretty bold claims about what you're going to do. We trust you, we believe you, we have confidence in you, and so we don't usually doubt you, if ever. I mean, a phrase that we use about reliable people, as good as done, right? That's what we want everybody to say. If I say I'm going to do it, it's as good as done. Or, man, you can take it to the bank. That's a reliable person statement. Those are phrases that we associate with reliable people. If they say that they'll do it, it is as good as done. You can take that to the bank. Now, in today's passage in Hebrews 6, the author of Hebrews addresses an important theological question, an important personal question. How can we have confidence in the as yet unrealized promises of God? How can we have confidence in the as yet unrealized promises of God? Starting at verse 13, we'll be reading through 16 for right now. When God made his promise to Abraham, since there was no one greater for him to swear by, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you and give you many descendants. And so after waiting patiently, Abraham received what was promised. People swear by someone greater than themselves, and the oath confirms what is said and puts an end to all argument. Our author in Hebrews, he starts out with this illustration to answer this question of whether or not we can have confidence in what God has promised us. And he uses this illustration that any Jew would understand. He's talking about Abram, who became Abraham. He's the father of the nation. He's the primary patriarch. The patriarchs of Israel are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Abraham is literally the granddaddy of the patriarchs. And if we go back to Genesis 12, where everything started for Israel, we read that Abraham was 75 years old when the Lord approached him with this proposal to pack up everything that he has, leave all of his family, and go to this other place where he's never been, he's never seen, and God's going to have him start a family. You know who's 75 years old right now? Yep. Yep. Can you imagine Clark packing up everything that he has, everything that he owns, and moving to Maine and starting a new family? Like this next picture, can you imagine? That's not Crystal's daughter, that's Clark's. Probably wouldn't be any more spoiled, but I talked with Clark about this last night, and I asked him if he was interested in packing up all this stuff and moving to North Dakota or some random place, and he said, nope, most likely I'll be moving to Wildwood. He said, nobody at that age is looking for adventure. They're looking for assisted living. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't a lot of very capable 75-year-olds in this room. In fact, there are 75-year-olds in this room that I would put against a good number of generations below me in a fair number of tasks. You folks are doers, right? But there are limits to that, aren't there? I mean, could you imagine being 75 and the Lord tells you that he wants you to pack up your life and move to a place you've never been or seen because he's going to make you, this 75-year-old with no kids, into a father of a whole nation? I mean, at 75, you are settled in. There's not a lot of people starting new families at 75. We have habits and routines and arthritis and no mortgage. So who moves at 75 so you can start having kids? Abram did. And he had to wait 25 more years before God fulfilled that promise. It says, patiently he waited, it says in our text. Now this might be more credit than he's actually due, because when we look back at the story, promise and invitation, you know, all of that comes in Genesis chapter 12. But just a few chapters later, Abram questions God. He's like, man, I still don't have a kid yet. And what he's worried about is, according to the social norms of the time, if he doesn't have any children of his own, Eleazar, who's one of his servants, he's going to inherit everything. And so he's worried a little bit. But the Lord assures him he's going to keep his promise to him. A few chapters later, we read about Abram trying to make it happen himself by having a son with Hagar. Sarai is on him and saying, hey, like, it's not going to happen, so take my servant and we'll get a son that way. So to say that Abraham waited patiently might be a little bit of an exaggeration, a little bit of a stretch, except to point out it was 25 years. Years before God gave him Isaac. I mean, think about that for a minute. How many of us have waited 25 years for anything? I mean, patience isn't exactly a virtue that we pursue very well. We have credit cards and fiber optic and 5G phone service. We want access to all of our show episodes at once so we can binge watch instead of having to wait week to week for an episode. We are not patient people. And we know that God doesn't always work on our timetable, but we are eager and impatient and hasty. And he is slow and patient and steady. But if you look closely enough at these verses, you may have picked up that the patience of Abraham isn't actually the point this verse in Hebrews is making. If you're paying attention, we realize that this isn't about praising Abraham. It would be wrong to think that Abraham was the hero of this story. The existence of this story in Hebrews is not about Abraham being patient, but that the Lord was faithful. God delivering on his promise is the point being made. That's what he's drawing our attention to. That's what our spiritual tour guide, the author of Hebrews, wants us to see, that God was faithful to do what he said he would do. And if we're fair, It makes sense to wonder and doubt. I mean, the plan that he has, that he proposes to Abram, is ridiculous. Make a nation out of a dusty womb. I mean, it's an incredible thing to say that it will happen, but it did happen. And the nation of the Jews would come from this line, and their number would indeed be vast as the stars in the sky or the sand on the shore, uncountable. Now, in between the call to move and the explanation that he would bear a child and become Abraham, and the actual birth of Isaac in chapter 17, God reassures Abram, and this is where he actually changes Abram's name to Abraham, and he calls him Abraham because it's a play on words in Hebrew to say somebody is the father of many nations. It sounds like you are saying Abraham. And he told him he would do it, and then even later after that in chapter 22, Abraham is standing over his son with a knife in his hand. And that's the moment when the Lord swore an oath to Abraham that no matter what happens, his promise to him will come true. And that is what our author of Hebrews is pointing to in verse 13 and 16 when he says that God swore an oath. When God made his promise to Abraham, since there was no one greater for him to swear by, he swore by himself, saying, "I will surely bless you and give you many descendants." And so after waiting patiently, Abraham received what was promised. People swear by someone greater than themselves, and the oath confirms what was said. That oath that he gave when they're standing on Mount Moriah confirms what it was said, and it puts an end to all argument. But look at verses 17 and 18, because those are the verses that tell us why all of this took place and why any of that matters to us now. He says, "Because God wanted to make the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, he confirmed it with an oath. God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope set before us may be greatly encouraged." In 1806, Mason Locke Weems published The Life and Memorable Actions of George Washington. And in that publication is included this famous story of a young George Washington hacking away at his father's cherry tree with a hatchet. And most of us are familiar with this story, right? And what happens next. Now, here's how Weems writes the story. "Truth, George," said his father, "is the loveliest quality of youth. I would ride 50 miles, my son, to see the little boy whose heart is so honest and his lips so pure that we may depend on every word that he says George's father. Now, it doesn't include this in the text, but at that point, George gulped. I mean, he laid that on thick, did he not? "I can't tell a lie, Pa. You know I can't tell a lie. I did cut it with my hatchet," admitted young George. Washington's father was supposedly then beside himself with pride in his son's rectitude. "Glad am I, George, that you killed my tree, for you have paid me for it 1,000-fold. Such an act of heroism in my son is worth more than 1,000 trees." Now, we don't really know if this actually happened or if it's just a legend told to beef up the character and quality of George Washington, but the line, "I would ride 50 miles to see the little boy whose heart is so honest and lips so pure that we can depend on every word that he says," it may not be true of George Washington, but it is true about God. Because our author says it is impossible for God to lie. He doesn't go into detail. He doesn't explain what he means by that. He doesn't embellish. He just says it like it's just a matter of fact that God cannot lie. It is impossible for God to lie. So what does he mean, impossible? I mean, can't God do anything? Does God have any limits? Is there anything that God cannot do? I mean, don't we teach that God is sovereign, that there is nobody and no thing that can prevent him from doing what he wants to do? Isn't he omnipotent? Unlimited? What does he mean, impossible? Doesn't the Bible teach that with man it is impossible, but with God, all things are possible? Isn't that a contradiction? No. It's impossible for God to lie in the same way that in Mark chapter 6, it explains that Jesus could not do any miracles, except a few, in his hometown of Nazareth. I mean, clearly he could do some because it has that little anecdotal, except a few, comment that's put in there. But in that story, the deciding factor was the lack of faith in the people of Nazareth. It's his hometown. They knew him growing up. They couldn't fathom anything special about this small town nobody. And so it wasn't a lack of ability on Jesus' part. It was a lack of faith on their part. Jesus has merely chosen not to do miracles in the absence of faith. Miracles were used to grow faith, to convince people that what they hoped to be true was actually true. Now, I want to be careful with this because sometimes people mishandle this idea and they make more out of it than what is actually intended. Can we ever control God and make him do what we want by our faith? Is our faith stronger than God's ability or than God's will? Is he ever compelled to do our will instead of his own because we have faith? Absolutely not. He is sovereign. He doesn't have to do anything that he doesn't want to do. Just because we have faith doesn't mean that he has to act. He is still the Lord, not us. We do not control him. On the other side of that coin, is he unable to perform miracles unless we give him permission by having enough faith? Be careful how you answer that. Does our lack of faith prevent him from healing? Is his power dependent on our belief? Does he need us in order to act on our behalf? No. He is the sovereign Lord of the universe. Nobody and no thing can prevent him from doing what he desires. The only limits that God has are those he puts on himself. And it's not even really truly a limitation, but it is a choice. He chose not to act in Nazareth because there wasn't any faith. And again, let me make this abundantly clear. It is not because the people didn't have enough faith for Jesus to heal. That is terrible theology. The line of thinking that if I have enough faith, God will do blank, makes God my puppet. And it sets me up as the boss instead of God. Jesus makes the statement one time that if we have faith the size of a mustard seed, that the most amazing and incredible things can happen. So hear me on this. It is not the quantity of our faith that moves God, but the presence of it. It is not the quality of our faith that matters, but the object of our faith. It's not the quantity of our faith that moves God, but the presence of it. It is not the quality of our faith that matters, but the object of our faith. That our faith is in the Lord is what makes it powerful. And the only reason that God cannot heal in the absence of faith is not a matter of ability, but of choice. It's because he's chosen not to act in the absence of faith. It's not because of any limitation. It's just merely a choice. And the same thing is true with lying. Why can't God lie? Because he is holy and unchanging and perfect. And lying is deceitful, selfish, and mean. And God is none of those things. God cannot lie because he chooses to never lie. It is completely against the character of a holy God to be deceitful and to lie. To put it simply, God can't do things that he won't do. And since God won't lie, that means that everything that God says is true. 100%. Always. Every time, without exception, God never lies. Every time God speaks, it is truth. So why then does he speak an oath to Abraham? Was it necessary? Everything that he says is true. I think of it as if he's doubling down on his honesty. Our passage says that he is confirming what he has already said with an oath. To me, it's like a heavenly, divine pinky swear. Did God need to swear an oath to do what he was going to do? He did it for Abraham to have an extra measure of confidence that he would follow through. It was unnecessary because God always does everything that he says he will do. But because God is kind and he understands that we are weak and we are prone to doubt and to wander and to wonder, he double proved that it would happen by making this vow. I solemnly swear by my own name that the thing which hasn't yet happened one day in the future will happen. It was reassurance. That story is for us. Abraham couldn't see how it was possible that he could have children, and the longer it took, the harder it was to believe, and to the point where he attempted to do God's job for him. It wasn't that God was in default of the contract, it just wasn't the right time yet. And God's timing is always perfect. But he took the oath to double down on his truthfulness. It was like he was saying there, I've said it twice. Now you can really believe it. It's like when the first baseman catches the ball, he tags the base, but he also tags the runner for good measure, just to erase any question, any measure of doubt that the player is out. They're doubling down on it. Out, out. The author points to this story for believers in his time as if to say to them from the Lord, I've given you my word in two different ways. Hang in there. It will all be worth it in the end. And he tells us this so that they and we will be encouraged and get a firm handhold on hope. In verse 19, he says, we have this hope as an anchor for the soul. Firm and secure. My word is true. My promise is true. Cling to hope. The author writes these words so his people will cling to hope as an anchor. Hope is hard, though, because we have this propensity for doubt And what hope is relying on something which isn't here yet. It's trusting in something we don't yet have. That's the nature of hope. It's in something not yet. Every Kansas City Chiefs fan is hoping for a 2024 Super Bowl win, right? Rooting for it, planning for it, hoping for it, expecting it. How many Chiefs fans are hoping for a 2023 Super Bowl win? Yeah. Why would you hope for that? You already have it. We don't hope for things that we already have. We hope for things that we don't yet have. And our author says, let your hope be an anchor. Seeing how God was faithful in his word and his promise to Abraham, look at how all of that turned out. Did God do what he said he would do? We can have confidence in his word and his promise to us. Hope is our anchor. Now, this has been up here the whole service, just moving around, and I'm recycling an illustration that I used, I don't know how far back, in a previous sermon, but it was just too good not to use again. Because this balloon has been going all over the place. And if we didn't have the air conditioning turned down to 63 because we're running on one unit right now, I would have turned this up even more. But I thought, man, if I turn this up and really get this balloon moving, somebody's going to come up and turn this off. Is this balloon out of control? No, it would be easy to think that because it's moving all over the place and it's very random and very chaotic and it can seem like it's out of control. But why is it not out of control? Yeah, it's anchored. It's tied to the brick. It can never get more than 3.5 feet away from that spot, so it's not technically out of control. If I cut the ribbon, if I separated it from the brick, then it would be out of control. It would be free, but it would be out of control. God's made promises to us also. He's made promises of heaven, of forgiveness, of seeing loved ones again, promises of everlasting peace, and we don't have those things yet. Just like Abraham didn't have a son yet. We hope for them. We can't wait for them. We eagerly anticipate them. But this world tosses us around. And sometimes in the chaos of life, what we need is a little bit of assurance that despite how crazy things look to us, we can cling to the hope given to us by somebody who does not ever lie. You know what this is? Somebody go ahead and say it's a brick, because it is, right? Yes. But what else is it? It is God's unchanging promise. It is a fixed truth. It is unmovable. I might as well have tied this balloon to the building, because that would have been a more accurate picture that this balloon's never going to move around so much to move this brick, but it's definitely not going to move this building. But it would still fall short, because we know that sometimes buildings fall, don't they? Tornadoes come and wipe them away, and they get tornadoes destroyed, but the eternal word of the living God does not fail. And he has made promises to his people. I go to prepare a place for you. Whoever believes in me shall not perish but have eternal life. I am the resurrection and the life. I have come that you may have life and have it to the full. I have come not for the healthy, but for the sick. I come into this world to seek and save the lost. So when your life feels chaotic and you are tossed all over the place, hope in the promises of God is your anchor. It's what reminds us that even though this world seems like it is out of control, there is still a God in heaven who holds the keys to everything. He created us. He loves us. He sees us. He plans to redeem us and fix us. And that is a promise. Pinky swear. Will you stand with me as I pray? Father God, we come before you today as people who have lied. We own up to our inability to always speak the truth. We cover things up and we say things to make ourselves look better, to make other people look bad. We change details. Because we don't always speak the truth, it's hard for us to believe that anyone else does either, but you never lie. Your word is so true, it has the power to create. You spoke things into existence with your words. Because you spoke, they became real. We are prone to doubt, and to fret, and to worry. Cast our anxieties aside, Lord. May we live in the confidence that your promises are as good as done. We can take him to the bank. Help us, Lord, to be as faithful to you as you are to us. Give us wisdom. And we ask, Lord, that you would guide and direct our steps as we head into this week. May our choices reflect the truth that we have heard from your word. We thank you for your Son. And the gift of salvation we receive through him, it is in his holy and precious name that we pray. Amen.